I can't read all of it, it might take 2 hours to read all of it.
Pretty impressive.
Okay, the CSS Shenandoah was an iron-framed teak plank full rig ship and captained by Confederate States Lieutenant Commander James Waddell, a North Carolinian with 20 years prior service in the U.S. Navy. Shenandoah was launched in August 17, 1863, one of the most feared commerce raiders. And for the rest of the story tonight, we'll have the speaker who has books in the back, Mr. Dwight Hughes. He's here tonight. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1967, spent 20 years in the Navy as a surface warfare officer, and also did tours in Vietnam. He taught at Navy ROTC at the University of Rochester, earned a master's degree in political science, and a master's degree in information services management from USC. He's a Dwight is an author that works with the Emerging Civil War Group, which is part of Chris Bukowski and some of the other guys down there in Fredericksburg. Outstanding group. He lives near Manassas, Virginia, with his wife Judy, a former Air Force officer. Let's give a big hand for Mr. Dwight Hughes.
Okay, thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here today. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
If I start fading, please let me know. Just a sec here, let me bring up my my text. Okay, we're going to talk about the CSS Shenandoah today. If I can get, there we go. Okay. Raphael Sims, former captain of the infamous CSS Alabama, introduced his memoirs with the following. The cruise of a ship is a biography. The ship becomes a personification. She not only walks the waters like a thing of life, but she speaks in moving accents to those capable of interpreting her. A ship can be, therefore, a central character in a life story through which we can view the past more clearly. Following in the wake of her sisters, the CSS Shenandoah was the last of the Confederate raiders. Her mission? To continue destruction of Union commerce, so effectively advanced by the Alabama, now resting silently on the bottom of the English Channel after her fiery clash with the USS Kearsarge in June 1864. We're going to, first thing we'll do is discuss the cruise itself. Well, let's see if I can master the technology here. Do I just push this or push it up? Or
push it up.
Push it up. Okay.
No one's ever been able to master that technology.
It's going back to the last one. Okay.
Try the other
one.
Try the other
one. It's going backwards.
Seems to work better when I go down. Okay. We'll talk about the cruise itself, the ship, the officers, the sailors, the strategy followed by Confederate commerce raiders, the international law. We'll make a visit to the far side of the world, and then we'll talk about the impact of the cruise. From October 1864 to November 1865, Shenandoah carried the conflict around the globe to the ends of the earth, through every extreme of sea and storm. She was purchased from British owners, armed and commissioned near the island of Madeira. At almost the same moment, in an ocean away, as autumn blazed the Shenandoah Valley, Phil Sheridan routed Jubal Early's rebels at the Battle of Cedar Creek, a bloody ending to the Second Valley Campaign. The very day that lost one Shenandoah to the Confederacy saw the birth of another. Shenandoah destroyed 8 Yankee vessels on her way around the Cape of Good Hope and across the Indian Ocean. In Melbourne, she caused a sensation. The people split into contentious political camps. One welcomed and celebrated their guests. The other demanded her immediate departure, while the royal governor and bureaucracy muddled and vacillated. This was the War Down Under. The British colony of Victoria had much in common with both the Confederate and the United States and manifested some of the same differences. Leaving Melbourne, Shenandoah sailed into the vast Pacific. At the island of Pohnpei, she captured 4 American whalers. Southern gentlemen enjoyed a tropical holiday, mingling with an exotic warrior society that was more like them than they knew. The history and customs of this land present both intriguing parallels and stark contrasts with the Confederacy. Burning Yankee vessels illuminated alien surroundings while Richmond went up in flames. This uniquely American conflagration flared simultaneously at both ends of the earth. As lonely rebels slept under tropic stars, guns fell silent at Appomattox. With morale restored by rest, recreation, and destruction, Shenandoah sailed once more, leaving an enduring legacy in this faraway place. While the war struggled to conclusion and the nation began to bind its wounds, Shenandoah invaded the north, the deep cold of the Bering Sea. She fired the last gun of the Civil War, 10 weeks after Appomattox, set the land of the midnight sun aglow with flaming Yankee whalers, and almost became trapped by ice. Shenandoah captured 24 vessels in 1 week, an unprecedented accomplishment that a few months before would have been greeted with jubilation in the south and despair in the north. Off the coast of California, a passing British vessel delivered news of the end of the war. Former Confederates became pariahs, men without a country, profession, fortune, or future, presumably subject to imprisonment or hanging as pirates. Their fears amplified by great distance, these Southerners could only imagine. Homes destroyed, families destitute and starving, menfolk imprisoned, dead, or executed. On 6 November 1865, Shenandoah limped into Liverpool. Captain Waddell lowered the last Confederate banner without defeat or surrender and abandoned his tired vessel to the British. He and his officers went ashore to reconstitute their lines. This is, as Admiral Sims describes, a biography of a cruise and a microcosm of the Confederate American experience. Shenandoah's predecessors, the CSS Florida and the CSS Alabama, have been prototypes of Civil War cruisers, built from the keel up for the purpose and magnificently suited. Small but sustainable for long cruises, light, fast, and lightly armed. But Shenandoah was a civilian vessel, converted, armed, and commissioned as a raider. Shenandoah was a British extreme clipper, built in Glasgow for the China tea trade, similar to the famous Cutty Sark, the last of the type now preserved at Greenwich. She carried a cloud of canvas, having crossjack, royal studding sails, jib topsail, and all the high flyers. Shenandoah was the epitome of the ancient art of tall ship construction and a prime example of the new technology of the machine age. She was the first composite clipper, combining the advantages of iron frames, planked with 6 inches of East India teak, sheathed in copper. Shenandoah was also the first auxiliary screw steamer, a clipper ship with a steam engine, to assist in calms and contrary winds, driving her comfortably at 9 knots. The propeller could be lifted clear of the water, and the telescoping smokestack could be lowered to reduce drag under sail. For, For commerce rating, this combination was perfect. Let my slides catch up with me here. Okay. For commerce rating, this combination was perfect. In a single vessel of relatively low cost, the advantages of fast sail merged with steam propulsion and minimum armament against a vast merchant fleet almost exclusively under sail and virtually unarmed. An overwhelming tactical superiority. Shenandoah could overtake almost any victim and outrun any enemy. Shenandoah ranks as one of the top commerce destroyers of all time. She was a precursor of cruiser warship types developed later in the century and which have been important components of all navies since. A ship is fundamentally a machine, an instrument of marine transportation, ocean commerce, and naval warfare. But to those who create a ship, to those who sail or encounter it, and indeed to those who study the records of one long past, a ship is a great deal more. It is a highly sophisticated artifact of human ingenuity. It takes on vibrant life and distinct personality. It engages the passions. Of course, she is all of these things, and not just an inanimate object, only because of the men in her life and due to their collective experiences in her company. I claim for her officers' men a triumph over their enemies and over every obstacle. And for myself, I claim having done my duty, recalled Captain James Waddell. Shenandoah's officers represented a cross-section of the Confederacy, from Old Dominion First families through the Deep South aristocracy to a middle-class Missourian. They included a nephew of Robert E. Lee, a grandnephew of founder George Mason, a son-in-law to Raphael Sims, grandsons of men who fought at George Washington's side, and an uncle of Theodore Roosevelt. All except the captain and the ship's surgeon were under the age of 25. The name Shenandoah honored the place, wrote Lieutenant William Whittle, where the brave Stonewall Jackson also always so discomfited the enemy. The burning there of homes over defenseless women and children made the selection of the name not inappropriate for a cruiser, which was to lead a torchlight procession around the world and into every ocean. The men of Shenandoah already had suffered 3.5 years of bloody, discouraging conflict, aboard puny gunboats and lumbering ironclads, up and down the interior waters of their fledgling country, frequently on the same vessels or in the same battles. A few were veterans of Alabama's 2-year cruise. These men consider themselves Americans, Southerners, rebels, and warriors, embarking on the voyage of their lives, defending their country as they understood it, and pursuing a difficult, dangerous mission in which they succeeded spectacularly after it no longer mattered. Having sacrificed careers in the Navy that nurtured them, they struggled to reproduce its essence in their new Navy, one with few ships. 2 of the 5 lieutenants had been deep water sailors in the United States Navy and 1 in the Merchant Service. 4 of the lieutenants had attended the new Naval Academy in Annapolis. And 2 midshipmen had been appointed to the academy before secession changed their loyalties. 2 of the lieutenants followed distinguished naval fathers who had served in Pacific exploring expeditions, in anti-slavery patrols on the coast of Africa, with Commodore Perry at the opening of Japan and during the Mexican War. 1 had been Naval Academy Commandant of Midshipmen. Both of these fathers became senior officers in Confederate service. Upon first sighting the ship, Midshipman John Mason recorded in his journal, "One thing, however, pleased me very much. She was a full rigged ship, and as I looked at her 3 tall masts and her yards and rigging, I thought what a fine opportunity I would have of learning seamanship, and I made up my mind to make the most of it." Watching an enemy vessel burn, wrote Lieutenant Francis Chu, was a grand and peculiar sight. I was saddened at the thought of being in duty bound to such work, I felt sorry for them, even after thinking of the hellish work of the Yankees at home, of the tears they have wrung from once happy, beaming eyes. No, none of us took pleasure in it. None but fiends could. Ship surgeon Dr. Charles Lining remarked about the vast and empty Pacific Ocean. Rain, calms, and baffling winds seemed to afflict us. Nothing in sight, not even a bird. In fact, the region seems to be the abomination of isolation. Three heritages drove the men of Shenandoah. As grandsons of revolutionaries, they believed profoundly in liberty and democracy. They also shared the ancient social mores of the Southern gentleman class, along with its timeless dedication to family, country, duty, and personal integrity. These characteristics were reinforced in their central identities as officers of the Confederate States Navy, to which they applied the Southern martial tradition just as energetically as did their Army brothers in arms. The observations of these Southerners, looking back from the most remote and alien surroundings imaginable, along with the viewpoints of the people they encountered, provide a truly unique perspective of the war, with elements both common to and differing from land-bound compatriots. The officers of Shenandoah were Americans, primarily of English and Irish descent, but the men they led were a polyglot assemblage of international merchant sailors enlisted in foreign ports or from captured ships with enticements of gold and threats of confinement. Shenandoah's crew represented that motley mixture of seafaring humanity operating within its own rigidly authoritarian and cramped society, customized through millennia to the unique needs of shipboard life, and hardly less strict in its way than slavery. It was still a class system, but based more on skills and experience. The sailors were of nearly every nation and color, mostly English, Irish, Scandinavian, and German, but also South Asian and Pacific Islander, along with a few born and raised Yankees. Most had never set foot on American soil. Captain Waddell also enlisted several African Americans, paying and treating them the same as other crewmen. He could not afford to do otherwise and would have seen no inconsistency in the notion. Confederate sailors had more in common with Union counterparts than with Southern compatriots. In contrast to soldiers on both sides, most mariners were products of poor and working classes from Northern and European cities rather than small towns and farms. America was still 80% rural, but these men represented the burgeoning urban industrial environment. Many were foreigners fleeing hunger and economic turmoil in blighted slums and factories where living could be harsher than at sea. Sailors possessed different values and ideas. They were inclined to be hard, pragmatic, cynical, and profane men who drank too much, fought too much, and prayed too little. Aggressively masculine, they did not aspire to gentlemanly virtues, sacrificial aspirations, or ideological motivations. Huge numbers of immigrants, former slaves, and working class men enlisted for individual rather than collective reasons, practical factors of economic need, ethnic tendencies, class outlook, and race. Theirs was a different kind of war, which aside from the few and infrequent actual battles, was marked by personal struggles with boredom, officers, religion, and alcohol. The time-tested maritime culture was unique and unquestionably different, with its own rituals reinforced by isolation from the constraints of society. But despite the discomforts of life at sea, a seasoned mariner understood that intense training, immediate compliance, close teamwork, and often extreme and dangerous exertions were required for survival through the perils of sea, storm, and battle. Coming from a rough background, he bonded with crewmates, took intense pride in his skills and courage, and developed attachment to the vessel. He would engage in almost superhuman effort on her behalf. When required, he could fight like a demon. Without this kind of man, a ship like Shenandoah was just a lifeless, purposeless object. Obtaining a full, experienced crew was one of Captain Waddell's most vexing concerns. His officers struggled to enforce naval discipline and loyalty to mission on foreign merchant sailors. The officers strove to earn the sailors' loyalty and to balance discipline with humanity, and they succeeded. Most sailors of Shenandoah served loyally and energetically through a very difficult and dangerous cruise. As a naval strategy, commerce warfare has been around since the 16th century, when Queen Elizabeth I dispatched her gentlemen adventurers to prey on Spanish shipping. European conflicts for the next 2.5 centuries saw almost continuous commerce destruction on all sides. Americans vigorously warred upon enemy trade in every contest leading up to 1861. Confederates turned immediately to trade warfare as a primary pillar of their naval strategy. The very able Secretary of the Navy wrote, "The enemy's commerce constitutes one of his reliable sources of national wealth, no less than one of his best schools for seamen, and we must strike it if possible." Captain Waddell of Shenandoah would note, "The war was only to be stopped on the mercenary principle of showing that it would no longer pay to keep it up." Mallory had no illusions about cutting off seaborne commerce to the north, but he did have two objectives. One, make the war so costly to powerful northern shipping and whaling interests that they would campaign vigorously for peace, even at the expense of southern independence. And two, weaken the blockade by drawing off Union warships to chase down rebel raiders. In today's terms, this was asymmetric warfare. With no navy at all to begin with, Southerners relied initially on tried and true privateering. A few rebel privateers made it to sea in 1861, but with short-lived success. European powers had declared an end to privateering and denied both contestants permission to bring captured vessels into neutral ports for adjudication and sale, while the blockade restricted southern harbors. For the first time in 300 years, the business was not profitable. The ever-resourceful Secretary Mallory determined to build or buy vessels configured solely for commerce destruction and fund them from the treasury, a practice not prevalent since development of the big gun warships centuries before. The strategy was to dispatch as many state-financed commissioned cruisers as possible among regular trading routes, taking any Yankees found there. Shenandoah was instructed to do the enemy's property the greatest injury in the shortest time. Meanwhile, the strategy of Union Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles with respect to commerce raiders was primarily reactive. He focused his resources on the blockade, reluctantly dispatching a few warships to pursue rebels where they were reported to be, usually too little too late. Shenandoah represented a novel breed, heroic warship to Southerners, feared privateer to citizens of neutral trading nations, hated pirate to Northerners. The status of Confederate commerce cruisers in the antiquated and complex body of international law was ambiguous, causing a great deal of rancor between London, Washington, and Richmond. The most effective rebel raiders, Alabama, Florida, and Shenandoah, were British-built, armed, equipped, largely manned, and sold to the Confederacy. Central to the controversy was the legality of such vessels as legitimate articles of neutral trade, along with British obligation to accord them equal status with United States warships. Alabama's dramatic and destructive cruise became a cause célèbre, an illustration of the pitfalls of neutrality and a source of extreme acrimony between the two nations. Shenandoah's visit to Melbourne throws these issues into relief. the people were fascinated by, if not entirely informed about, their faraway cousin's conflict. As word spread of her arrival, hundreds of sightseers streamed along the shore. Boats under steam, sail, and oar descended from every direction to view their first and only Confederate visitor. The Shenandoah is regarded as the Alabama Redivivus, or the phoenix-like product of the wreck of that world-famed vessel, noted the Melbourne Argus. The ship was besieged by sightseers traveling as far as 300 miles, evoking a carnival atmosphere. An estimated 10,000 came aboard in one day. If we can judge from outward signs, we are likely to find a good deal of sympathy here among the people, wrote Lieutenant Whittle. The royal governor and his advisors were less enthusiastic, being sensitive to convoluted diplomatic and legal issues surrounding the visit. Her Majesty's ministers demanded that colonial officials maintain both the fact and the appearance of neutrality in the American war, a delicate balancing act that had proven extremely difficult. Old and contentious issues concerning the rights and responsibilities of neutrals resurfaced, and there was no middle ground. William Blanchard, U.S. consul in Melbourne, carried on a fierce diplomatic war, a barrage of protests and affidavits. It must be evident, Blanchard contended, that all presumption of fact and law were against the legal character of the vessel, which had no legitimacy as a commissioned warship of a recognized nation. The undersigned will not doubt that your excellency will give so much weight and no more to a bit of bunting and a shred of gold lace as they deserve. Upon the advice of Crown law officers, the governor responded to Consul Blanchard. There was no evidence of piratical acts, and whatever the previous history of Shenandoah, the government was bound to treat her as a ship of war belonging to a belligerent power. That did not, however, end the controversy in Melbourne. The people of Melbourne, like their English counterparts and many foreigners, did not comprehend the complexities of the war, but in an age tinged with romantic notions of honor and valor, they related to the Alabama. She had been a tangible manifestation of the Confederacy. Her exploits brought the contest to them in the language of ocean commerce and ocean conflict, which they understood very well. Having no particular stake in the success of the Union or understanding of its concepts, many looked on the men of Alabama as valiant heroes fighting great odds. Captain Sims was an international celebrity, at least as much as Lincoln, Grant, and Lee. Despite vehement protests from the United States, Confederate cruisers have been welcomed warmly in colonial ports such as Jamaica, Trinidad, and Gibraltar. The Alabama caused a stir in Cape Town in August 1863, with parties and balls in her honor. Later, just the rumors of her appearance off Hobson's Bay created a flurry of excitement in Melbourne. Much of this glamour transferred to Shenandoah, which is precisely what the Confederates intended. But a significant number of influential people were acutely worried about the visitors. The Melbourne Age wrote, "Whatever may be the pretensions of the Shenandoah, she is strictly speaking but a privateer. The method may be strictly lawful, but it is exceedingly inglorious, and they who engage in it are entitled to no honor. The day may come when the unoffending people of this colony may be made to suffer for the quarrels of nations in the other hemisphere." There appeared to be little public debate of central issues: Union, secession, states' rights, slavery. Pro-Union sentiment focused on repugnance for commerce raiding, dangers for the umbilical cords of trade with Europe and America, and local issues such as land reform and tariffs. The Civil War generated economic uncertainty, even in Australia, with widely fluctuating prices and availability affecting huge quantities of imports. Despite these concerns, The preponderance of sympathy in Melbourne was for the South, echoing perceptions and misperceptions of many in Great Britain and Europe. Conspicuous in gray uniforms, Shenandoah officers were approached on the streets, showered with social invitations, presented free open tickets by the railway company, voted members of the cricket club and of the prestigious Melbourne club, and attended the theater gratis. However, Consul Blanchard learned from his spies that the Confederates were actively recruiting new crewmen from among the citizenry. And this was a clear violation of British domestic law, not just slippery international law. The governor acted with uncharacteristic dispatch, impounding the vessel while high and dry for repairs to the propeller shaft. Intense excitement ensued in the city, with few neutral observers and rampant rumors of actual or impending violence. But upon further review, royal law officers concluded that the governor did not have a good case and could be liable if the vessel were damaged. He was compelled to release Shenandoah to the wide derision of many citizens and the press. Repairs completed, Shenandoah once more attained her natural element, cheered by a crowd of spectators on adjacent wharves. The colonial steamer of war Victoria and a few other vessels dipped their flags in salute, the last international recognition the Confederate banner would receive. The Melbourne Herald proclaimed, "Peace is what the Southerners asked for. Peace meaning recognition and a new empire. The Federals declare there shall be no peace without submission and their dictatorship. The South is engaged in a war of independence. The North has no more chance to conquer them than had Cornwallis. Australia need not trouble itself much either way," concluded the editors, but they wished to be clear on the subject. Europe had acknowledged the Confederate States as belligerents and ought to have declared the South an empire. It is ironic that sympathy for the Confederacy in Great Britain was concentrated in ruling elites of title and wealth, identifying with aristocratic Southerners, and fearing Yankee democracy, the tyranny of the mob. While many people of colonial Melbourne, more in tune with radical politics and the expanding franchise, favored the South as a champion opposing tyrannical central government. These Melbournians were on the wrong side of the war and the right side of history. 19 February, 1865. Confederate troops evacuated the cradle of the Confederacy, Charleston, South Carolina, to the encircling host of General Sherman. On that same day, the CSS Shenandoah sailed from Melbourne, repaired, resupplied, and with 45 new, illegal crewmen. The people of Melbourne returned to routine, continuing a march to independence of their own, and a close friendship with the United States of America that endures to this day. April Fool's Day, 1865. In the glow of dawn, soaring emerald peaks sprouted from azure seas as the CSS Shenandoah approached the island of Pohnpei. Luxuriant tropical foliage spilled to the water's edge. A welcome sight after long months at sea, Lieutenant Chu marveled at this mingling of green and bright aquamarine, which gave a cool, refreshing appearance to the harbor. Shenandoah captured and burned four Yankee whalers here, and they encountered an exotic warrior culture that seemed totally alien. The young officers of Shenandoah were fascinated by the island and its people. A beachcomber named Thomas Herrick served as pilot and translator for Shenandoah. Herrick claimed to have read of the war in newspapers brought by visiting ships and to have informed the chiefs about it. They were, according to him, great admirers of Jefferson Davis. Captain Waddell recalled, "The clash of Southern arms electrified the minds of men in the remotest parts of the earth. Its heroism and dash were borne upon the wings of the morning and wafted by the breezes into the very habitations of the isolated barbarians. Waddell invited the local chief to visit Shenandoah. They shared a pipe and They shared a pipe and schnapps in their captain's cabin, which put the chief quite at ease, and then toured the ship. The chief and his party were astonished and amused by the big guns, the steam engine, and the fresh water condenser, but seemed to comprehend and appreciate their functions without confusion or fear. According to the ship's surgeon, the islanders were slushed down well with coconut oil until they shone and smelt. Phew! Whenever they leaned up against any place, they left a mark. Meanwhile, a fleet of canoes surrounded them with sun pouring down upon bare backs, many holding up large green leaves as umbrellas. The chief departed in the best of spirits, inviting all ashore with a hearty welcome. The ship received coconuts, pineapples, pigs, chickens, bananas, and plantains, giving tobacco in pay. The Southerners considered the whole affair ridiculous, but the chief would have been greatly pleased. He was leader of one of the most powerful clans. Each side patronized the other to its own advantage, as is to be expected. But Confederates and Islanders had more in common than they understood. Both peoples stressed structured interaction within an ordered hierarchy, with well-developed rules of etiquette to lubricate the gears of society, a process intended to maintain a social order that Yankees refused to comprehend. April 3, 1865, Richmond defenses crumbled in front of Grant's rapidly advancing hordes. Along the riverbanks, Confederates fired magazines and cotton and tobacco warehouses. Exploding projectiles dropped over the town. Wrote one observer, morning broke on a scene never to be forgotten. The smoke and glare of fire mingled with the golden beams of the rising sun. The great warehouse on the basin was wrapped in flames. The fire was reaching to whole blocks of buildings. And as the sun rose majestically above the horizon, it burnished the fringe of smoke with lurid and golden glory. Curious crows watched the fire. Its roar sounded in the ears. It leaped from street to street. Pillagers were busy at their vocation, and in the hot breath of fire were figures as of demons contending for prey. Yankee cavalry burst into the city while a boat appeared on the James, carrying Admiral Porter, President Lincoln, his son Tad, and three aides. It was a mild spring day. Birds sang in the orchards on either bank. Trees were in bloom. As the party rode upriver, they observed a wide curtain of smoke ahead. President and company landed with a dozen Marines and walked through the town to the Capitol. A delighted Lincoln was surrounded by hundreds of black men, women, and children, some weeping for joy, others crying, glory, glory. It was evening in the Pacific. Lieutenant Chu of Shenandoah ignited piles of broken-up furniture in one of the whaler's cabins and saloon. The fires caught and spread quickly fore and aft, issuing great volumes of smoke. He remained below longer than was prudent before making an exit to the upper deck and began heaving empty tar barrels and oil down the hatches. Flames burst from hatch openings as he leapt into the boat. Nearby, another whaler was went up on the reef and set aflame, all in drenching rain. By dark, both ships burned furiously. Barrels of whale oil shot immense flames high in the air as masts came crashing down one after the other. The sight was grand and melancholy, the fruit of months of toil so soon destroyed, wrote Lieutenant Chu. Another officer recalled, the burning vessels sent forth a lurid glare, which lighted up like the eruption of a volcano, the quiet bay whose waters were disturbed by scarce a ripple, and the tropical shore far inland, with its strange vegetation and grotesque humanity. This uniquely American conflagration flared simultaneously at opposite ends of the earth. The people were constantly around the ship, bartering fruits, shells, and curiosities, as well as pigs and chickens. Like Southerners, Pompeians placed more value in land, although held communally, and in inherited social position and power than they did in accumulated material wealth. Communal rituals of hospitality and feasting, with strict obligations of superior and subordinate, differed in content but not in purpose. While violence, communal rituals of hospitality and feasting with strict obligations of superior and subordinate differed in content but not in purpose, while violence, when called for by individual or tribal honor, would look very similar. Shenandoah officers amused themselves touring, hunting, sailing, swimming, and trading tobacco or cloth for native curios, while, unbeknownst to them, the guns fell silent at Appomattox. Lieutenant Chu visited the village, encountering groups of men, women, and children sitting on the ground, jabbering, eating, and smoking. We spent a little time contemplating the scene. I thought, happy beings, not a care to trouble you. Nature had provided a mild, delightful climate and placed food at their door. Their wants were simple and easily satisfied. He was particularly entranced by a young girl, so small, so sweet, and so innocent. She had an open and intelligent countenance, her dark face lit up with joy, and such eyes, words cannot picture them. I looked upon this poor, innocent, beautiful little savage with admiration and pity. Pompeians weathered the vicissitudes of foreign contact without serious disruption to their way of life, a characteristic the Southerners would have appreciated and respected. Captain Waddell paid a final courtesy visit, informing the chief that he would convey to the Confederate president the kindness shown Shenandoah and the respect paid the flag. The captain presented the chief a silk scarf, which he admired, and received in turn an artfully woven belt of coconut fibers and wool. The chief bestowed two dead chickens wrapped in coconut leaves and a dozen coconuts as gifts for President Davis. Through the interpreter, the host responded, "Tell Jeff Davis he is my brother and a great warrior, and that I am very poor and that our tribes are friends, and if he will send your vessel for me, I will go see him in his country." Waddell preserved the coconut belt as a memento from the only sovereign who had an independence of character and a fearlessness of disposition to perform a common duty toward a righteous people and a just cause. It could be noted that the Confederacy had finally, 3 days after Appomattox, achieved its primary foreign policy objective. Recognition from and offer of assistance by a foreign power. They had been 12 days at the island. Approximately 120 sailors left behind from the destroyed whalers, Hawaiians, other Pacific Islanders, and a few New Englanders, were caught up in island politics and war. Their descendants are there today. A historian of the island wrote, "Pohnpei is one of the most interesting and colorful of all Micronesian islands." Similar statements have been expressed about the uniqueness and character of the American South. Pompeians and Southerners both experienced wars, rebellions, epidemics, forced labor, land seizure, and colonial domination, as well as modern economic practices. But, concluded the historian of Pompeii, far from submitting to the consequences of any fatal impact with foreign influences, Pompeians have shown themselves capable of adapting creatively and constructively. In short, Pompeians have managed to survive successfully in a modern world, not totally of their own making, and not completely within their power to control. The same could be said of Confederates and their descendants. Eight rebel commerce raiders destroyed over 100,000 tons of Union shipping, worth $17 million. But the major impact had been psychological, the real damage done by fear of capture. Marine insurance rates soared, reaching as high as 8% in 1863. Although only one in 100 Yankee vessels actually was taken, another 800,000 tons, about 1,000 ships, were sold into foreign ownership to sail under the protection of a neutral flag, primarily Great Britain's. This was called the flight from the flag. It was a blow from which the United States Merchant Service did not recover for decades. Despite these losses, however, rebel cruisers put not a dent in the industrial war machine of the United States or in the burgeoning trade that supported it. Commerce just shifted to neutral bottoms, and whaling was ebbing anyway, while the blockade progressively throttled the South. Fending off howls of protest from Northern shipowners and shippers, Union Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles diverted only a few warships from the blockade to hunt for Confederate cruisers. USS Kearsarge sank Alabama only after she completed the most destructive cruise of the war and was too tired to continue. USS Wachusett took the unsuspecting and unprepared Florida in Bahia Harbor only by an egregious violation of Brazilian neutrality. Shenandoah encircled the globe without being caught at all. Most other Confederate raiders were penned in neutral ports, confiscated before they could get underway, or decommissioned after unproductive cruisers. But this was also deliberate economic and psychological warfare, not unlike the strategy of William Tecumseh Sherman, torturing his way through Georgia and the Carolinas. In the fall of 1864, when Shenandoah began her cruise, Northerners were pessimistic about victory. Union desertion surged and the government was deep in debt. Bloodbaths at the Wilderness, Spotsylvania, and Cold Harbor, and stalemate in the trenches around Petersburg brought a chorus of condemnation down on President Lincoln and General Grant. Pressure to negotiate peace was intense. The president despaired of winning re-election in November. In October 1864, again when Shenandoah began her cruise, Confederate Navy Secretary Mallory wrote to Commander James Bullock, his chief purchasing agent in England, the man responsible for acquiring Shenandoah. "I trust that it has been in your power to carry out what I have long had so much at heart. The success of Shenandoah would be such an effective blow upon a vital interest as would be felt throughout New England." Bullock, a Georgian, is an unsung hero of the Confederacy. He thwarted persistent Union espionage and intense diplomatic pressure to launch Florida, Alabama, and Shenandoah, along with blockade runners crammed with hundreds of tons of arms and equipment, the Laird Rams and the ironclad CSS Stonewall. He was justifiably proud of these accomplishments. Bullock had been slated to command Alabama, but reluctantly retained his shore duties upon request of Secretary Mallory. In a letter to Mallory reporting Shenandoah's successful departure, Bullock remained convinced that, quote, "a formidable naval expedition could be fitted out by the next summer," that is, the summer of 1865. What if Shenandoah had been active in the summer of 1864, achieving the same results on top of the destruction already wrought by her sisters? How would news of another Alabama loose in the Pacific during the summer doldrums of 1864 have contributed to Northern malaise and to Lincoln's re-election prospects? The Confederacy might have been as close to independence that summer as at any time during the war. This was not an irrational strategy. By the spring of 1865, however, when Shenandoah actually reached the Bering Strait, there could be no such hope. The CSS Shenandoah combined the epitome of an ancient maritime heritage with the most advanced technology of the time. She represented a new concept in an old strategy of naval warfare and was a good example of what a weaker naval power can accomplish in what we today call asymmetric warfare. The men of Shenandoah heeded the call of their leaders, putting their lives, fortunes, and honor on the line. They sought to serve in the best traditions of the United States Navy, from which several came and which they took as their model. Judging by their accomplishments, they succeeded. The Americans of the South took up arms with courage, dedication, and sacrifice. And their naval arm was a paradigm of innovation, creative strategy, and professionalism under nearly unmanageable circumstances. The Shenandoah and her men deserve to be remembered. Along with their Union counterparts, they have much to teach us. It's a Confederate biography, and it's a great sea story. Thank you. My voice notwithstanding.
Could you kind of outline for us, like, the strategy when they would take multiple vessels, and there's the one vessel, and how they would, you know, render that into a profit, you know, and you know, cash it in, so to speak.
Well, the ancient tradition was for either a privateer, which was a private vessel with a warrant to take enemy ships, or for a commissioned warship, whenever they encountered a vessel of the enemy or that they thought was of the enemy on the sea, they were entitled by international law to stop that vessel and inspect it. And they inspected it according to international rules if it was an enemy vessel owned by the enemy, or if it carried contraband articles of war for the enemy, they were entitled to take that vessel. Now, what they would like to do was to take it back to their home port or back to a neutral port, where they would take it in front of what was called an admiralty court. And under international law, the court looked at the papers, and if they decided, yes, this was a legitimate capture, a legitimate prize of war, then they condemned the ship and awarded it to the capturing nation. And then it could be sold, and the profits returned to both the country and to the ship and the captain and crew who captured it. Unfortunately, because the Europeans changed the rules after the Crimean War, they decided they didn't want to do privateering anymore. So during the Civil War, they said that neither side could bring ships in for sale. And of course, this favored the South because the North, or the Confederates, didn't have any merchant ships to capture anyway, so the North didn't really engage in the practice. And anyway, because they couldn't take it in for sale, they had to destroy the ships. And they either sank them or burned them or whatever, but they always took the crew off. The crew and their personal baggage was safe, could not be touched, and they put the crew ashore or put them on, or they would take one of the vessels, one of the older, weaker vessels, and they would do what they call bond it. The captain of the vessel would sign an agreement on behalf of the owners, agreeing to pay the capturing nation the value of ship and cargo at the end of the war. And then they would put all the prisoners on one of these ships and let them go. And they did this with several ships. And of course, at the end of the war, if the Confederacy had achieved its independence, that would have been legitimate international debt and they would have been able to collect it.
It was kind of like paroling on land.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And but of course they didn't, and so. Another question.
What sort of armament did the Shenandoah have?
Let's see, she had two 9-inch rifles and four 68-pound smoothbores. British guns, primarily, they're British guns. She was actually armed very similar to the Alabama. Her armament actually was as good as any of the Union ships who, had they caught her, she would have fought. The same was true of the Alabama. The Alabama's armament was as good as the Kearsarge's. The problem was two things. In the case of the Alabama, her powder was 2 years old and wet and wasn't any good anymore. Yeah. So, and two, her sailors being captured, being constricted or bought, merchant sailors were not as trained at the big guns. So they couldn't achieve as nearly as rapid a rate of fire as the Kearsarge. Okay. Now, the Shenandoah had the same problem. I mean, she probably had some decent powder, but her crew were not well trained, and they had no intention of fighting if they could possibly avoid it. And as it happens, there was one Yankee ship that got a week or so behind her at one point across the Indian Ocean, but they never had the necessity to fight.
For ships that were months and months at sea, did they still have a problem with scurvy at that time?
Shenandoah, right toward the end of her cruise, started getting some cases of scurvy as she came up the Atlantic and approached Liverpool. But she got into port and they got some help and it wasn't serious. So most of the time, in those days, by that time, most of them stayed on top of the scurvy problem as long as they could get fresh provisions.
And so what happened to the Shenandoah at the end of the
day? Well, the Wardell just turned it over to British authorities. The British authorities, in turn, turned it over to the United States authorities there in Liverpool. At first, they hired a crew and tried to sail her back to the United States, but the crew was inexperienced, had problems with the engine, big storms, they didn't make it, so they went back to Liverpool. And the U.S. finally decided, well, we have this, they put it up for sale. And it was bought by the Sultan of Zanzibar as a yacht. And it actually was then sailed down to Zanzibar, which is an island, as you know, off the east coast of Africa. And the Sultan of Zanzibar used it as a yacht for a number of years until it was damaged in a typhoon and eventually sunk in the Indian Ocean. And that's where it lies today.
What happened to Captain James Wardell and his officers after that, when they had to leave?
Well, eventually they all made it back home. Okay. But they didn't come home right away. Wardell and his wife stayed in England until I think 1875, and then they came home. A number of the officers went to South America and tried to establish lives in Argentina and a couple in Mexico. Tried farming and other things, and none of it worked out very well. But all of them wanted to come home. They were reluctant to come home at first because they weren't sure of their status, and they weren't sure whether they could get pardoned or. But eventually, as things eased up for the Confederates, they all ended up home. and they all resumed their, for the most part, their pre-war lives. Some became lawyers. One whose father had owned some plantations got his plantations back. And they all had productive lives. They were perfectly happy to go back and be good citizens.
Were all the sailors on the ship in the military? I mean, would they have records? Did they get a pension of any kind down the road?
No, virtually none of them were in the military. They were foreign merchant sailors who were hired. And in those days, even in the Navy, when you took on a sailor, you enlisted a sailor, or in the merchant service, you hired a sailor. It was hired by the ship for the length of that cruise. Okay, there was no professional enlisted service at that time. So they were hired, and they were paid two or three times the going rate for sailors, because they had to pay for them. Otherwise, they couldn't have had a cruise. They were offered gold. They were promised prize money from the sale of the prize at the end of the war, which, of course, they didn't get. But after they got back to Liverpool, there were actually enough Confederate funds left in Liverpool, and there were Confederate English sympathizers, the rich, wealthy English sympathizers. They actually did pay off the crew. And as far as we know, most of them got paid the full value of their wages for the crews. The officers didn't. They got pennies on the dollar, and they got what they could get and went on their way. But that was...
It's a mystery to me how James Bullock was able to get these ships commissioned. Was it in Liverpool?
Mm-hmm.
While the Union was watching.
Well, it was.
How the heck did he do it?
That in itself is a very complex and thrilling espionage story, which deserves its own book. I think there is a book out on Bullock, and he did an amazing job, and the Union was constantly fighting, and they were fighting with the Brits, and the Brits were in a very delicate situation there, because the building and construction and selling of ships was a legitimate business. They had every right to sell ships and arms and ammunition and anything to either side. But on the same time, the United States became very incensed over the fact that the Brits were building and selling these raiders to the Confederacy. And as a matter of fact, there were a couple times where they came as close to going to war over the issue, as you can imagine. And that in itself, the whole international aspect of the war is something that's not often appreciated, but it's fascinating. Because Secretary of State Seward, threatened war on a couple of occasions if the Brits let these, like the ironclad Laird Rams were a couple of very powerful ships that they had built. They were ironclad, steam driven, with turreted guns on them. They were the latest stuff. And if they had gotten into Confederate service, they would have raised all sorts of hell. But the United States just told the Brits, if those ships get in Confederate service, it means war. And so the Brits told the Confederates, you're selling those ships to us. So they sold them to the Brits. They had to, no problem. And actually, that's how Bullock got the money to buy the Shenandoah. So he put the money to get one ship, the CSS Stonewall, was another ironclad vessel, the latest thing, right at the end of the war. It's the only one that really got through several intermediary steps and a lot of sneaking around, got into Confederate service, and it was underway across the Atlantic when the war ended. And it ended up going to Bermuda, and they just abandoned the ship there. The Stonewall actually ended up in Japanese service.
let me save the rest of your voice and just give you this and thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
More questions, let's go see Dwight in the back of the room, and want to wish everyone a wonderful Christmas, Happy New Year, and we'll see you back in January with a whole new group, whole new sleet. So drive safely, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I got extra water for you. I know how it is when you start to lose your voice, man. It's like,
spread the word. Everybody's not doing anything on a second Thursday.
Yeah.
I've spoken many times about halfway through when you lose your voice.
Yeah.
This is rough.
We talk all day. Kids.
Oh, do you?
And if you're on a break, like Christmas break, and you come back, you're not, your voice is not ready. Sorry.
Good seeing you guys. A very good book.
Sure. Right. The best part